Right now I'm joined in studio by Green Party leader and Minister for Integration and Children, Roderick O'Gorman. And there's a lot to talk about, Minister. Let's start with the news about another 2 weeks parents' leave from today.
Morning, Anya. So as a Green Party minister, one of my central goals over the last 4 years in my department has been to better support parents and better support children. So from today, we're adding an additional 2 weeks of paid parents' leave per parent. When I became minister in 2020, it was 2 weeks per paid leave per parent, but working with Minister Humphreys, we've grown that now to 9 weeks per parent. It is per parent, so it's for mams and dads, and it's a really important support to parents, allowing them to spend time with their newborn in those crucial early years. And I think the success of the policy is shown by the rates of take up in 2020. About 16,000 people applied for paid parents leave. Last year it was 78,000, so it is a really important and really successful support to parents in those first 2 years.
So between parents' leave, parental leave, and maternity and paternity leave, what do parents get now?
So mams get the 6 months of maternity leave plus the 9 weeks plus the 16 weeks of unpaid parental leave, and dads get the 2 weeks of paternity leave and the 9 weeks paid parents leave. So it's a significant growth over the lifespan of this government, and I suppose it works with other policies that I've brought forward. For example, increasing the time where breastfeeding breaks can be taken from 6 months to 2 years, introducing remote working, introducing flexible working for carers, and obviously the steps I've taken to cut the cost of childcare for parents.
And I suppose the question now is where you go next. Do you start giving parents more leave on top of what has already changed, or do you increase the rate? I think it's 275 a week. So do you give them more money or more time?
And I think certainly that's something our party will be giving real consideration to in our manifesto for the general election when it takes place in the next number of months, and seeing how we can best support parents. Look at the take-up rates. It's improved very significantly, particularly for dads, but it's still not at the same rate as mams. We're lagging behind other European countries. We've made progress, but we'd like to bridge that gap. So that may be about increasing the actual rate of the benefit for maternity leave
and for
parents' leave.
So the money may be having an impact on who can take up the time.
It probably does have an impact. And I suppose the question is, and look, this is something we'll be considering as we develop our manifesto proposals. Is it about increasing the rates, or is it about increasing the amount of time? And what's the most effective, what's the most impactful support that we can give to parents and children?
You also launched the new National Traveller and Roma Strategy yesterday. What's that actually aiming to deliver?
Well, we know travellers and Roma are two of the most marginalised communities in our country. We've seen some improvements in their situation over the last number of years. So educational progression has improved, but I think we all recognise there are stark inequalities faced by those communities. So we've set out a range of areas where we want to see progress over the next 4 years, and we've set out, I suppose, measurable differences we want to achieve. So in the area of employment, for example, we've made a commitment to a 50% increase in the number of travellers who are in employment. We've set out a number of measures, an internship scheme in the public service, enterprise support through SciCaps. One issue that's of particular interest to me is supporting the participation of traveller and Roma kids in ECCE. Those are those 2 years of free preschool that almost everyone takes up. There's a 95% take-up rate of ECCE in Ireland. In the traveller community, it's 73%. So on day one of junior infants, the kids who haven't done this are already facing an educational gap. So the Equal Start programme I announced a number of years ago, the DESH model for early years, has a specific stream targeting travellers, giving greater support to traveller parents so their kids can access the ECCE programme, and we can narrow that gap of attendance.
Which of course has a huge impact, doesn't it, on outcomes and
attendance. A huge, and I think it's that early years investment that I think is so crucial, because the gap, the educational attainment gap that builds there can't really be resolved at second or third level.
You said yesterday that asylum seekers will be housed at Coolock in Dublin and at Dundrum in Tipperary, despite the protests we've seen in recent weeks.
I did, because my department continues to need to provide accommodation for international protection applicants. We have individuals, we have families arriving on a daily basis, and we have a statutory duty to make provision for them, to provide them with accommodation. And we will, we plan to use both of these locations for that accommodation.
And the High Court has refused an attempt to bring an injunction against Dundrum being used. Is that right?
It is correct. And I think in Dundrum, it's important to say that the location here hasn't been used as a hotel for years, long before I became a minister, long before even COVID. This site wasn't being used for a hotel. It has been used to house 280 Ukrainians successfully for over a year. And we will be using it for the same number of international protection families. And I believe that, you know, the welcome, and I recognise the welcome the people of Dundrum and surrounding areas provided over the last year for Ukrainians. I've no doubt that that same welcome can be extended to international protection families as well.
You don't need a community audit to tell you that many of the people who live in Coolock, many of the people who live in Dundrum, they say no. They don't want this development. They say they haven't got the resources, particularly they say whatever, you know, they don't have the resources, for instance, if it's mainly men who move into the area, to deal with all of that. How can it work if the local people don't want these facilities there?
Well, on a very basic level, in terms of when male applicants are accommodated in an area, we know the vast majority of those, once their 6 months within which they can apply for work permits is passed, they'll go to work and they will work in whatever is available in the area. And we know across much of Ireland, be it whether it's Ukrainians or international protection applicants, they're actually a very significant part of the labour force at a time when we have real shortages in our labour force. But on the wider question, where a community raises a concern about pressure on services, be it the GP, be it schools, be it public transport, the community engagement team in my department, we hear that and we look to provide the solution to that. And I think that's entirely reasonable. Yeah. I think it's, I understand where communities raise issues about pressure on services, and it's up to government to respond to that. But where it is a broader issue of we just don't want these people, unfortunately, government can't just respond to that, because we have a statutory duty. And nobody, as we've said before, nobody has the right to say, I won't allow X or Y into my community.
Are working class communities and small rural communities being asked to do too much in terms of accepting facilities for refugees in their areas compared with leafy suburbs and more middle class areas?
We have international protection accommodation in working class areas, in rural areas, and we have it in middle class areas as well. We have international protection accommodation all over the country now at this stage. And I suppose our department...
Is there a bias against the poor and the rural because it's more easy? I don't know.
I don't believe there is. And certainly if you look at the percentage, the very significant largest percentage of international protection accommodation is in the Dublin area, and I think that shows that there isn't a bias against rural areas. But what the point I will make in terms of the comprehensive accommodation strategy I launched a number of months ago, looking to create that core of state-owned accommodation, so we move away from this over-reliance on the commercial.
Yeah.
I've been very clear that by doing that, it allows us to plan where we're going to locate those state-owned accommodation, and that allows us to ensure that we aren't locating that in areas which have already, I suppose, are already accommodating large numbers of either international protection applicants or Ukrainians.
And, you know, you spoke about your department engaging with communities' concerns, but, we've heard politicians, even politicians from government parties, complain about the lack of consultation. This idea of community audits and getting the consent of a community, how much does that weigh on you? And is there anything more that could practically be done to increase that engagement? Because we have heard that criticism from government TDs.
Well, a year ago, I would have accepted that criticism. There were areas where we had to move very quickly and we weren't able to undertake community engagement. But I know there's been maybe 60 or so meetings have been organised by our community engagement team with local representatives, with community leaders, all over the country. And I suppose we're talking about two locations today where there has been very significant controversy. We also have to recognise that over the last year we have opened significant amount of international protection accommodation where there hasn't been controversy, where our community engagement team have worked with local political representatives, with community leaders, where we've been able to bring in solutions to the service issues that have been raised, and where people have accepted that they're hosting people in their area, and the state has stepped up in terms of putting in additional facilities.
And how do you solve the violence that we've seen, for instance, in Coolock in recent weeks? We see, and it's not unique to Ireland. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Hartlepool, look at Southport, look at Downing Street.
The question of misinformation and disinformation, I think, becomes more and more prominent, and both in terms of what happened in Coolock, where it was put up online that a well-known coach company had refused to engage with our department, entirely untrue. They'd no relationship with us originally. The rumour that there was a busload of international protection applicants on site, again, all untrue.
But drones flying in petrol bombs, that's true.
Yeah. And there's a real issue with the use of this information by really very clearly bad faith actors in terms of trying to influence particularly young people who maybe draw all their kind of information from social media sources rather than from the more traditional mainstream sources. And I think we're seeing, as you pointed out, the exact same thing happening in the UK. So it's not a phenomenon unique to Ireland. As you know, we've brought in legislation, we've brought in the Online Safety Commissioner to look at the regulation of the large platforms and to place a greater onus on them in terms of
legislation soon.
We would hope to see that coming in the autumn term. I think it is really important. We saw 651 hate crimes take place in Ireland last year, and those are the ones that were declared to the Gardaí. It is really important that
and
we
you
join.
Want to see that on the statute books before you leave government.
I want to see legislation outlawing hate crimes on the statute books. Yes.
Minister for Integration and Children, Roderick O'Gorman, thank you for coming in to talk to us on Morning Ireland.